For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. This is the MJA Podcast. When we last spoke to Professor Alan Cheng about COVID-19 back in March, Australia had 375 confirmed cases and 5 deaths. At the time of recording this today, Wednesday the 20th of May, we have 7,072 confirmed cases, just 530 of them are active, and we've had 100 deaths. By any global measures, Australia has done a decent job of flattening the curve, but many questions remain as restrictions start to lift. Professor Cheng, the Director of Infection Prevention and Healthcare Epidemiology at Alfred Health, is back to give us an update. He is joined today by Professor Deborah Williamson, the Director of Clinical Microbiology at the Royal Melbourne Hospital. Alan, well, the last time we did a podcast on COVID was back in March. How do you read the situation now compared to how it was back in March?
Well, things have changed a fair bit since,
yes, they have.
Since March. We've had a big surge of cases, mainly related to people coming back from overseas, and then it's largely settled down. So we've really moved into a second phase of what to do now, and over the last couple of days there's been the announcements about relaxation to some of the restrictions. But this is going to be a really important time to keep an eye on things and make sure that we don't get any new outbreaks occurring.
Deb, you were so busy back then that we couldn't find a chance to talk to you. What's been your unit's role and what have you been up to in the last couple of months? What's been your big focus?
The laboratory that I had has been providing testing for Melbourne Health. And, you know, there's this real paradox at the moment whereby some of the physical distancing measures are being relaxed and, you know, there are very few cases in Australia, and we're in this fantastic position globally whereby, you know, we've really done a marvellous job, but the laboratory is almost busier than ever. Sort of as the rest of the country is breathing a little, almost a sigh of relief. You know, we are, in order to support that, in order to support those physical distancing relaxations, the laboratory has to provide a very high-intensity testing service. And so I think that we'll continue to do that for the foreseeable future. And we've really been through the mill, I think, in not just my laboratory, but laboratories across the country. It has been absolutely disruptive. You know, many of us have never seen anything like this.
Just for context, David, it might be worth how many respiratory PCRs would you normally do a day in a normal winter, and how many COVID or SARS COVID two PCRs are you doing now?
So anything between, you know, in a height of winter, maybe between 50 and 100 tests for influenza on a very busy day. And that's just my laboratory.
Yep.
But, you know, over the weekend, for example, we did upwards of 500 tests a day.
Wow.
For coronavirus. And that has stretched the laboratory workforce to the max. And overlaid onto that, you know, some of the challenges in testing have included external pressures like shortages of testing reagents, you know, quite a complex regulatory framework, complexities in interpreting positive and negative results in certain settings, and a pressure to get results out quickly to certain populations. So the challenges in the laboratory setting have been at some points overwhelming. But, you know, the workforce has more than risen to the challenge.
Brilliant.
One thing that we had to do was to split our staff roster into two so that, you know, we didn't have overlap of really critical staff who were performing the testing. And again, in the face of that, you know, the sheer scale of testing, that was also a challenge. One thing that we were very cognizant of, I should say, is that, you know, we were aware that there may be PPE shortages if we were faced with a huge number of cases and the scale of the testing as well. And we were keen to explore some novel approaches to collecting specimens and to try and reduce the use of PPE.
Okay.
And so we did some work evaluating saliva as a diagnostic specimen. And you know, we found that that was a useful diagnostic sample in our setting.
As you said, Alan, we've done pretty well. I think we've got about 700 active cases across the country, and each state has got less than 10 on ventilators right now, and 98 deaths so far, which is terrible, but a lot better than it could have been. Do you fear that there's a second wave coming?
Oh, look, I think it's something we always really need to watch out for, particularly as restrictions are relaxed. I'm hopeful that sort of the relaxation of restrictions are relatively small steps, but I think it'd be fair to say that there are indications that a lot of people are getting pretty sick of them, and possible that compliance with restrictions, you know, mightn't be quite so strong going forwards. But we really need people to try and do their best to stay with it, because we certainly know what happens where there aren't restrictions, that things can get out of hand very quickly.
This seems to be a fairly mysterious little bug sometimes. I mean, compared with what we knew about it in March, what are some of the things that have changed about what we know? Has there been any surprises since then?
There's probably a couple of things. So one is that asymptomatic, or at least in pre-symptomatic infection and possibly transmission, seems to be a bit more common than we had thought.
Okay.
So in SARS, in 2003, that almost always didn't occur. And we think that it probably does occur. We're okay. Not entirely sure to what extent and how long people are infectious before. It probably is sort of 24 to 48 hours. But that's a really important thing. It does seem to be more transmissible than SARS in that regard. So the, okay. sort of the degree of how we can control it is probably a bit more difficult because of that.
What's the reproductive factor at the moment? Do we know?
Oh, look, it varies with the context. We think that in general it's thought to be between 2 and 3 still, but at the moment, because of all the control measures, it's probably well under 1. But actually having a small number of cases actually makes it quite hard to work out what it actually might be at the moment.
And would that be more in, for example, the context of an aged care facility? Or a meatpacking plant?
The effective R is usually sort of a population averaged and a number, and you don't usually sort of consider it in special circumstances. But certainly the attack rates in aged care, so Newmarch House and Dorothy Henderson Lodge, seem to be quite high, and certainly in other settings that they have relatively high attack rates as well.
What can we learn from what's happening, for example, in the US, where it all seems to be fairly chaotic and uncontrolled? Does that situation act as a bit of a petri dish for the rest of the world? Do we?
Yeah, look, I mean, so all the big outbreaks in the US are really in 3 major settings. So that aged care settings, detention facilities, so, you know, correctional prisons and so on. And then, curiously, meatworks, where people work quite close together and they often get transported together. So obviously the context is different in Australia. We don't have, I don't think we have meatworks to the same scale that they do in the US. But it's probably no coincidence we've had an outbreak in a meatworks in Victoria as well. So I think the common thing that sort of we have seen across different countries is that it really does seem to find the weak spots of lots of different countries. So where are the sort of places where people might have missed the message or not understood the significance of the disease, or have a disincentive to be tested because they're casual workers and can't take time off to get a test, or maybe marginalised for some other reason. Don't have good access to healthcare. So the foreign worker dormitories in Singapore are probably a very good example of, you know, those sort of factors coming together. And in the US, it's the same. So I think when we're thinking about Australia, they're the sort of factors that we really need to think about. Where are our vulnerable populations? Where are our weak spots? And obviously remote Indigenous communities are one of those.
Yes.
Casual workers and other things like that. Populations like that are obviously important.
Is this thing mutating?
That is an excellent question. And there has been a recent study published around some 6 mutations, but all bugs will mutate to a certain extent. And one of the difficulties that we have at the moment is standardization in how we sequence and how we analyze the genomes of the virus. And that makes assessing mutations quite challenging. And so, you know, one of the key things that we really need as a global laboratory community is some consensus on, you know, the best practice for sequencing the virus and for, I guess, assessing mutations and reporting on them as well. You know, one of the things that is a real hallmark, I think, of this outbreak is the kind of open sharing of scientific data. You know, that was a very early feature in that, you know, the Chinese investigators released the genome of the virus quite quickly.
Yes.
What that enabled, you know, rapidly after that was the development of diagnostic assays, which were subsequently, you know, rolled out across the globe. And so there has been a lot of work done now by regulatory agencies to try and, you know, develop frameworks for validating and monitoring the performance of these diagnostic assays. But, you know, one could argue that the same principle should be applied to some of the genomic assessments of the virus as well. The flip side to the open sharing and early sharing of scientific data is that it can sometimes be difficult to, particularly I think for the media, to distinguish between really high quality, robust scientific data and things that may not make it through, you know, to high quality peer reviewed publication.
How different is this bug from, say, 2003 SARS or MERS? Is it markedly different?
It belongs to the coronavirus family, and there are seven members of the coronavirus family known to infect humans. And
right.
Four of them are associated with, I guess, seasonal upper respiratory tract infections. So that's MERS, SARS-CoV-1, and SARS-CoV-2, obviously, are associated with, you know, these outbreaks of respiratory disease. And so, broadly speaking, they're all part of the coronavirus family, but they're distinct enough to be, when you compare them at a genomic level, they are sufficiently distinct to be given their own taxonomic classification.
There's been a bit the last few days from the States, and also I noticed that Brendan Murphy was talking about needing some research into the Kawasaki-like illnesses that have been turning up in kids, particularly in the States. What do we know about that, Alan? What's the go?
It's not entirely clear whether this is Kawasaki's disease. Mm-hmm. So there are a number of features that are actually similar and some of them that are different. So
right.
The things that are similar is that they can get kids can get a rash. I think one patient has been described to have some coronary artery involvement, which is characteristic of Kawasaki's disease. But equally, and it sort of looks a little bit like unusual and severe form of Kawasaki is called Kawasaki shock syndrome, sort of found in like 5% of Kawasaki disease. So it's a pretty uncommon disease. But that said, there are things that are quite different. So obviously, it's not been described in relation to coronaviruses before, although we don't know what the cause of Kawasaki's disease is. The age of patients is different. So the average age, I think, is over 10, and that's a pretty unusual age group for Kawasaki's disease. And then the last thing is that Kawasaki's disease is traditionally described in East Asian populations, so particularly
right.
Chinese and Japanese. And in the cases that have been described, we don't have many of them, but there's the other ethnic minority groups, so black and I think it's Afro-Caribbean children have been involved. So
okay.
It's probably pretty early days to work out if that's actually a signal.
So it could in fact be a Kawasaki mimic that coronavirus
it's not clear if it's just a different disease, whether it is sort of a little bit more like Kawasaki disease or not.
I'm chatting with Alan Cheng and Deb Williamson about COVID-19. The MJA is continuing its rapid review process for all COVID-19 content. We have a dedicated COVID hub on our website, which you can find at mja.com.au/journal/COVID-19. All coronavirus content is open access. If you're enjoying this podcast, you can find all our archived episodes at mja.com.au/podcasts, or you can subscribe to our feed on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Back to our chat. Back in March, when we were talking about children, at that point it didn't look like kids were involved much at all. Has that changed?
So yeah, I think it's important to say that this is a very unusual and rare complication. Mm. So the report in The Lancet had 8 cases in 2 million children.
There you go.
In London, quite a lot of children probably have been exposed to SARS-CoV-2.
Yeah.
And in New York, I think it's like less than 2% of the reported cases of coronavirus infections in children have been with this. I think in general, children still are underrepresented in the surveillance sticks, though, it is thought that children probably don't get infection to the same extent that adults. The NCS followed up all the cases that had occurred in schools, and in, I think, 18 cases where there were half of them were in teachers and half of them were students, they only could only find, I think, two cases of transmission, one from student to student and one from teacher to student. I think what it probably goes to is that we may be relatively comfortable that kids aren't at risk, but it does mean that, you know, teachers still need to be protect themselves. They need to feel confident that they can work safely, and also that parents, when they drop off their kids, you know, should be socially distancing so they don't infect each other at the school gate.
So I guess the other thing we need to talk about is vaccines. Is there any update? Is there any news on that front?
Yeah, there's a little bit going on. So there's, I think, more than 110 vaccine candidates that have popped up around the world. And obviously, there's a lot of work that's going into sort of getting those through.
Mm-hmm.
There's still quite a lot of steps to go. I think only a couple are into phase two trials to see if they can actually get a dose to make sure they can actually make antibodies that might be protective.
Yeah.
And a couple of the promising ones are looking like... there's an adenovirus vector one that's sort of probably the most promising of those, but certainly there's a lot of other candidates and much more simple vaccines that are also out there that might work. So it's still pretty early days. We don't have a good read on how protective they might be and how we would use them and how safe they are, but at least there's things happening in that area.
Do you get a sense of the timeline? Are we still looking at 12 months, say?
Oh, look, I think it's still going to be a while off. So if you think of all the steps that we need to do, they need to have, shown that their antibodies, that the antibodies are protective.
Mm.
They need to do some sort of field trial to make sure that it doesn't make it worse and that it's safe to give and so on.
Yep.
And then even after that, it's got to be approved by regulators and a program has to be delivered and they have to be manufacturing at scale. So there's quite a lot of steps still, and even I think 12 months would still be a pretty ambitious timeline.
Deb, I know there are a couple of types of tests. There's diagnostic tests and antibody tests. Are we doing enough of either or both in Australia?
I guess the testing for SARS-CoV-2 can, I guess, broadly come under the umbrella of diagnostic testing, and it can be nucleic acid testing. So that's the PCR testing that's related to the swabs that people have up their nose, and that's really the gold standard for the acute diagnosis of COVID-19. But I guess some of the emerging work now is on antibody testing, serological testing. And that's really the place of serological testing, I think, is still finding its feet.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of complexities around that. So I think Alan mentioned about antibody detection in relation to vaccine work, but serology tests rely on the detection of specific antiviral antibodies. And, one of the complexities at the moment is that we don't really know if the amount or the type of antibody that's produced is actually protective, if it confers immunity to reinfection. And I guess another challenge has been that determining the right antigens to use in the test to maximize the sensitivity of the test, but also minimize cross-reactivity to other coronaviruses has been really challenging. What that means is that the development of high-quality serological tests has been much slower than molecular-based diagnostics.
Would you rather it that way than the way the US went and just privatised the lot and said, go for your life, sell them?
Oh, look, we're very fortunate here in Australia. We've got these regulatory agencies and these frameworks in which we operate. And, yes, there has been some, I guess, fast-tracking of diagnostic tests, necessarily so, into the Australian market, but we've got enough checks and balances in the system whereby we can monitor the performance of those tests and recall them or modify them as needed. We're building on a strong public health infrastructure here around assay development and testing and deployment.
Yeah. It sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, that both of you think that Australia has done pretty bloody well at this point.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's early days, but I think we certainly can't say that it's over by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah.
And I think the experience in Singapore is that, you can think you're doing well, but something's flying under the radar, and we need to be really cautious about that.
But the response so far has been pretty agile. Tell me what you think.
I think we can look to countries that haven't responded so well, and we're certainly very happy that the government has listened to medical advice and has, there's a lot of very experienced people that in charge of the jurisdictional public health unit around the country and have dealt with infectious diseases for a long time. So, and there's a whole system behind that, so all of PHLN and the laboratory network, obviously, supporting that. So they're getting good expert advice, and that advice has been taken on. So that's sort of a plus, I suppose. But, again, we don't know what we don't know. And we're all need to be very watchful.
Deb, has this pandemic brought about some changes in the way you operate that will stay in place even after this is over? In other words, has there been a silver lining to some of this?
You know what, it's hard to gauge at this point.
Yeah.
but, you know, I guess on a personal level in the lab, it's really fostered that sense of teamwork in the lab.
Yeah.
And I have to say I'm enormously proud of the work that my lab has done in this regard. But also, you know, the labs across the country have, their response has been overwhelming, really.
Fantastic.
But I think in terms of being able to scale up testing quickly and put measures in place to do that, to respond to the next pandemic, and there will be one,
yes.
Then, you know, that sense of preparedness, I think, has been very useful in the in the laboratories. One thing I would really like to say, and we may cover this later, Kate, but I think that the communication from scientists to government and to the public has really, again, been a defining feature of this pandemic. And, particularly people like Alan, who is probably too modest to say this himself, but... You know, as somebody that has been providing regular updates on Twitter, which has really been, a critical forum for dissemination of information.
It has and been,
some
hasn't it?
Yeah. Misinformation. Of course, that never comes from Alan. But, you know, Alan has really been a guiding light for much of the infectious diseases community in Australia in this outbreak.
Fantastic.
Oh, no, thanks, Deb.
I think...
That's true.
It is true. Have either of you got any doubts or worries about the next, say, 3 or 4 months?
My major worry is sustainability.
Yes.
So it's just and resilience of the workforce.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to particularly in relation to testing. And so, you know, we've got a pretty fatigued workforce at the moment, and I think that is something that we just need to be cognizant of.
I think our hospital's probably under quite the same pressure, similar pressures to Deb's.
Mm.
I mean, I think that it'd be fair to say I don't think there's ever been a public health intervention that is a test. So, you know, using testing on a population-wide scale, saying, you know, anyone who has symptoms or even doesn't have symptoms can get a test, isn't something we've ever tried before. And that is, a whole level of magnitude more than we've done ever for anything else. And I think that's where, Deb's gone from, 50 to 100 tests to 500 to 1,000 tests a day. That's a lot. That really is sort of...
And that's not just labs having to scale up either. It's just getting the tests done. It's administering the tests, making the tests, producing the reagents, all of that.
It's very much stretching every part of that supply chain, the workforce, and you know, the actual how many swabs we actually have, and the reagents we use to run the test, and you know, just how many machines we have. All of these things that just haven't been used in this sort of way before.
And now that they have, or now that they're in the process of being scaled up, it shows you what can be done when it has to be done, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think when this is over, there'll probably need to be some thought as to what the best model for doing this, in the, you know, if this ever happens again. Maybe there are better ways of doing it than to stretch all the labs right to the limit.
Anything else, Deb? Do you have any final thoughts on the whole sitch, or do you just need a good vacation, basically?
Pretty much.
You guys must be thoroughly sick of this entire topic.
There's always something different. There's always something different, you know, every day with it. So it's not that, like, with coronavirus so far, no 2 days have ever been the same.
Where do you get most of your stuff? I mean, where, what is it? Homemade? Is it Australian made? Or is it all overseas stuff?
Now that is a choice question. You know, most of our reagents for laboratory testing have historically come from large overseas companies. And so this testing at this unprecedented scale has really sort of stretched those international supply chains. And what that's done is made us turn towards sovereign supply chains, if you like.
Yes.
And really emphasised the need for local manufacture and distribution of things related to laboratory testing, whether it's swabs and innovative approaches like 3D printed swabs, for example, or plasticware to support the tests, or manufacture of laboratory reagents themselves, has put things into sharp relief around supply chains for laboratory testing.
And some work for the future, you think? That's where things could be better for the next time,
Oh, thanks, Kate.
Thanks, Deb. Thanks, Alan.
Good. Thank you very much.
Take care.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Cheers.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.